This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Hello, this is Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Last month, consultant developmental pediatrician Dr. Rajni Savanandan spoke about fears and phobias among children. Today, she returns to further explore anxiety disorders that our young ones may grapple with. Our phone lines, as always, are open. So if you have any questions about anxiety among children, today's your day to call. That phone number is 0377109000. You can also text us at 0162019000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Dr. Rajni, last month, you spoke about fear and phobia in children. Today it's anxiety. How are these emotions connected?
Anxiety is basically a response that we have that in a way is a protective response in some children, but it becomes a disorder or a problem when it starts to interfere with the child's functioning and ability to socialize and develop normally. Of course, fears and phobias are things that all children go through. They develop phobias when anxieties to specific fears take over their lives and interfere with that particular aspect of their life or generally socializing in particular. You know, part of the reason of carrying on this topic is because general anxiety is also slightly different to fears and phobias. Of course, phobias can be described as a specific anxiety disorder, but we are also seeing a lot of children who have anxiety beyond specific triggers that we talked about in our last show.
That was exactly what I wanted to ask. What causes generalized anxiety among children? Because I think you see that in adults, you know, people who just feel generally anxious. It's kind of a default state almost. But, you know, when you look at a child and you think, what are you anxious about? You know, this should be the happiest period of your life. What causes that anxiety?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, people forget that adults were children once, and a lot of anxiety disorders that our psychiatric colleagues and psychologists see actually start off in childhood. So we all know that genetics plays a role, and we keep going on about this, but we also see that you know, children who are anxious often have adults around them who are anxious. Now, genetics is one part, but we know in anxiety disorders, environment plays a big role as well, right from the infancy stage. So we know that children who have insecure attachments with their mothers, they are more predisposed to anxiety disorders. We also know that there are children who are born with anxiety, or we want to call them anxious personalities. But there's
neuroticism?
There's a term that we use amongst, you know, people who work with children with behavioral issues, psychiatrists, psychologists. We call it behavioral inhibition. And these are children whose reactions to environments are a little excessive. Anxiety reactions to environments are a little excessive. And actually, these children generally have higher baseline heart rate. They have higher stress hormone levels, and this has been proven scientifically as young as, you know, 4 or 5 years old as well.
What other physical symptoms of anxiety would you see in children? You know, if a parent's watching a child play, for example, are there things that you should be looking out for aside from nervous behavior or, you know, other forms of social conditioning?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's good you brought that up, because children are not able to express anxiety symptoms. They can't tell you, oh, my heart's pounding, or, you know, I'm starting to feel sweaty. For the children who can verbalize and they can describe a bit of pain, you might see that they have stomach aches, headaches, you know, not being able to, or, you know, I'm tired now, I can't go any further, if they're trying to avoid a particular situation. For younger children, it may be their reaction. So you're talking about play. For example, a child who is comfortable in a particular environment may play, explore naturally. But when faced with anxiety, that play stops, or the child starts getting extremely clingy. Of course, people would say a lot of children are clingy, but it's to what extent. And if that child is particularly clingy with repeated exposure and is not starting to explore after some time, you do need to worry.
How common are anxiety issues among your patients? You know, do you see a lot of it?
In my practice, yes. I deal a lot with children with behavioral and different needs. And we do know that anxiety disorders, for example, are higher prevalence amongst children who may have attention deficit disorders, autism, learning disorders. But in the general population, I think it's sort of under-recognized because we know that anxiety disorders can affect up to about 8% of preschoolers and higher, up to 16 to 20% in some adolescents as well.
Preschool, that is one of the few times, I think, in my childhood that I can remember feeling deeply anxious. I think, you know, for many people, it's probably the same. It's the first time you go to school, yes. You're exposed to a whole new environment. And then hopefully you get over the whole first day of school thing. But how can parents kind of deal with the fact that as your children age, you are naturally going to be putting them into more and more stressful environments because that's just a part of growing, you know? So if you have a naturally anxious child, yeah. What kind of coping mechanisms or safety nets do you need to have in place to make sure that they can actually do these things without giving into anxiety?
Yeah, I think firstly, it's important to recognize that your child has, is maybe the anxious type and not the type that explores. We do know that, we can feed or we can promote anxiety disorders by the style of how we deal with children. So positively or negatively reinforcing that avoidance behavior or that, for example, by forcing a child straight into a situation that they may be anxious about.
Like throwing them into a
pool.
Yeah,
throwing them into a pool repeatedly. I think maybe if you throw them once and you can see that they're scared, you may want to, the next time take it slower or introduce toys in. So it's how you approach it. If you do it negatively by punishing a child each time that he doesn't want to go into that pool, again, you may be reinforcing that behavior. So, and at the same time, we say overprotective parents or extremely detached parents, they tend to miss signs of anxiety or enhance the signs of anxiety. So I think it's about, gradually introducing that child to that environment, especially if that child is overly anxious.
How do we differentiate between regular anxieties and ones that seem persistent? Because I can imagine that if you start to, let's take school as an example, because once you start, it's every day, right?
Yes.
And you might start to kind of just think that, well, this is just the new reality now. Every time I send my kid to school, they're going to get upset. And that's a normal reaction because it's separation, because they don't want to go. How do you know when it's normal and when it's not the new normal and your child is really having anxiety?
Okay. I think, we have to remember that it's very common for children to have separation anxiety, especially the first time they go into school. And it depends on the age as well. I mean, separation anxiety from parents is at its peak between 9 months and 18 months. By 2.5, it should be pretty okay. That's a good age, we say, that, children will separate from their children. Of course, the first few weeks, it's going to be traumatic for that child. But once the child sees that this is a routine, I'm starting to enjoy my new environment, you will see that that child settles down. There are scenarios where the child will cry when the parent separates from the child. And again, it's maybe a response thing that they're trying to elicit a particular response from the parent. But as soon as the child goes in,
they're fine.
They're fine. These are the children you see who cry. The minute they walk in and you peep through the window, they're playing with their friends. So I wouldn't say that child has an anxiety. But if that child continues to cry in the school, refuses to eat, or you can see that intense fear in the child when you send the child, then that's the time to worry. The thing to remember is sometimes this so-called anxiety may be separation with a particular parent. So sometimes we say to parents, try with someone else sending your child in as opposed to you sending your child in for a period of time and see whether it makes a difference. if it does make a difference, then you know that child doesn't have a general anxiety issue and that things aren't going to settle down. Maybe you have to change your way in how you send your child.
As you mentioned earlier, when it comes to anxiety, in your field in particular, you'll see it a lot because it comes attached to other conditions. But do you have parents who seek consultation for their child's anxiety issues as a standalone? And at what point does that happen?
Yeah, you know, increasingly I am seeing children who present with symptoms where there's school refusals or something else called selective mutism, where they just refuse to talk in social situations, particularly school. I can't quantify, I guess, how many percent of those are that standalone. But increasingly in my general pediatric clinic, this is aside from my developmental clinics, I am seeing parents come up to me and talk to me about children having anxiety symptoms, especially in social situations, actually, Lynn, nowadays. Schools or particular classes that the child starts exhibiting things like stomach aches and headaches. So I would say on average in a week of typical kids I see who may have it, maybe one or two. I mean, it doesn't sound a lot, but...
But in the grand scheme of things, you have anxious children running around.
Yes.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Rajni Savanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician. We are discussing anxious children or children who are living with anxiety. And if you think that your child might be among them, if you've got any questions at all on how we can help them, that phone line that you can call is 03-77-109-000. You can also drop us a text at 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. Rajni Savanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, here for her monthly show discussing anxiety among young children. As always, our phone lines are open. So if you've got questions, if your child is anxious and you'd like to find out why that is happening or how we can help, how you can help, that number to call is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Dr. Rajni, earlier you said about 1 to 2 children you're seeing now in your general clinic. So are we, you know, perhaps being alarmist over this issue of anxiety in children? Like, I think that for those 1 or 2 children, it's clearly a really big deal. But overall, is it something that we're placing too much emphasis on?
I worry because I think we are going to see more anxious children the way our school systems are going, with the emphasis on performance in schools, where, be it academic or, you know, we're into so many competitions and winning so many things that there are some children who feel the pressure and start developing anxiety symptoms as a result.
We've spoken before about, I mean, on the show, we've spoken about how things like anger can be a motivator. We've talked about how you can harness negative emotions into and turn them into positive action. Now, this is something that I think adults might find easier to do than children. But is anxiety ever useful?
Yes. Like I said, it's, you know, it's in us to, it's a sort of protective mechanism, really, you know, to make a step back, think about the possible danger that may be there. And I guess for most of us, we would be able to analyze that rationally and tell ourselves whether the danger is clear or, you know, it's just something that it needs getting used to. So it's sort of the same in children. But I guess with children, the environment also will mold how you respond to that situation.
That stepping back and being able to look at something logically and assess it, I mean, you could argue pretty strongly that I think that's something parents should definitely be equipped to do for their child. So when you see that your kid is having, you know, having these symptoms, starting to have these stomach aches, headaches, things of that nature, what should be the very first action you take?
I think initially we always agree that, you know, if a child's presenting with physical symptoms like that, you want to be taking it seriously. Even if you've sort of have a hunch that this may be, a response to an anxious environment or a particular trigger, I think firstly you need to acknowledge that your child is having these symptoms and explain to the child that, yes, I know you're feeling that way, so we're going to see what's causing that. And, you know, with all children, when they present with physical symptoms, what do? They want to go and see the doctor. And, or maybe they don't want to if they've got a specific phobia for the doctor. But I think it's important to tell your child that I'm taking this seriously, I'm trying to address it. The next thing would be also to look at what may be triggering this whole event. And if your child's articulate enough, talking through with your child. The other thing is, I think as parents, especially for preschoolers who aren't so articulate, always get to know the environments that your child is being exposed to. You know, you send your child to a preschool or a particular activity. Don't just choose it because people say this is the best place to go. You want to also be going and checking it out to make sure. Or if that's the only available thing that, you know, childcare or place that you can send your child for that activity, try and find out, especially if your child's exhibiting these symptoms.
What should we not do? So if those are the things, those are the actions we should take, on the flip side of that, what would you recommend parents avoiding?
I think I would recommend that parents avoid, firstly, denying the whole situation. I think it's important that parents not give in to that child's specific anxiety by saying, okay, we don't have to do that particular activity. I think it's important that parents also don't force that child to do it, but maybe break it down into simpler steps to allow that child to approach that particular activity. I think the other thing is also, you know, part of the therapy is, now I don't expect parents to be able to do this, and I think it's very important that parents consult, you know, people who can help their child. Obviously, most parents turn to a medical professional, but quite often, medical professionals may refer the child on to, say, a behavioral therapist or a psychologist. Because then what psychologists do, actually, is they try through play to make children or to identify what triggers the anxiety. They may also help children recognize their feelings and try to recognize those feelings and control those feelings. But there are specific ways of doing that.
Social anxiety, is that what you're seeing as the most common trigger?
Recently, yes. And, you know, like I said earlier, it presents itself as refusal for schools and particular social events, as well as children who are selectively mute, not talking in the environment.
You said recently, yes. What has it been in the past?
I don't know, because maybe I have to admit that I've only been back in Malaysia for the last 10 years. And maybe in the first few years of my practice, being in a tertiary centre where referrals are coming in for the more serious cases or the specialty that I was in, we were not seeing it. I wasn't seeing it so much. But since I've been out doing in my own practice, I'm seeing more parents come in with these issues. And I think a lot of my colleagues also would see that.
I'm unsure, to be honest, if this is a fair question to ask, but it's one that occurred to me. I mean, when we talk about the types of children who are more likely to be anxious, you mentioned that there is, if not necessarily a strict genetic thing or hereditary thing, there's certainly a relationship between the anxious adults you have around you and the anxiety that you yourself might feel. Are anxious adults the best people to recognize and then help a child cope with anxiety? Because if you've been living with it a long time, A, you might not recognize it as a huge problem. This might just be how you process. And B, you might yourself not be coping that well.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the parent, because I've had parents who bring in their children, and in the course of our discussion, and part of our medical history is to find out about parents and their lifestyles in a way. I'm finding that quite often parents themselves who have this anxious personality are actually, or they may have depression, and there is an overlap between the two, that they actually volunteer that information to me. And so, it works both ways. At the same time, I see situations where parents are in complete denial, and it's actually teachers who are bringing up, or maybe they're just not aware, teachers are bringing up the issue especially where children are socially very withdrawn, not talking in their social environments.
So it takes, I think we go back to the whole concept of it takes a village, then you exactly. really need to be able to observe different things and be open-minded.
Yes.
How important is the dread of loss, you know, of losing something familiar and dear when it comes to understanding anxiety in young children?
I think that's very important, especially in school-age children. And, you know, children are exposed to media nowadays. And I can tell you that last year, after the two Malaysian Airlines, the loss of the aeroplane and the crash, I know of a couple of children who were then starting to refuse to go on trips. I even had a child who comes to see me regularly from further away who actually refused to get onto a plane. And this child would often come across to Peninsula from Sarawak to visit relatives, etc. But he actually point blank refused to get onto a plane until this year and just recently in the last few weeks. And that only happened when the whole family in Sarawak got onto the plane together because he was so fearful of that. So I think for school-age children, this is definitely something that we need to address. This is often one of the triggers of social anxiety and school refusal.
We're discussing anxiety in children today. If you've got a question, you can ring us at 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. Now, when it comes to loss, the first loss you fear, I think, tends to be that of your parents. You know, they're the first people you love. Mm. They're the ones that you worry about. But on the other hand, as children grow, as people try to continue working, parents do spend more time away from their children. Does this detachment cause anxiety? I mean, we know people who grow up in latchkey households who have no anxiety. So yeah. What is behind that? Why do some people get anxious and others do not?
I think it boils down, I mean, people would argue, but it actually has been shown that it depends on your attachment in infancy. If you've had that secure attachment, it bodes well for you in the rest of your life, presuming that you don't have any genetic predisposition to being an anxious person, presuming that there's no family history of anxiety or depression in your family. So, you know, I think, again, we're back to genetics, but it's the attachment in infancy and in those early years that matter. Of course, there are children who are born into families where there is a very secure attachment, etc., but maybe genetically they're anxious children, and it also depends on the traumas that they face as they get older.
There are also children who are mostly raised by caregivers, by nannies. And of course, the thing about nannies is that they have to go home sometime. So how do children cope with that, you know, with the idea of this changing caregiver?
Again, it boils down to the attachment. I think
the attachment to
your caregivers. You know, it doesn't mean that you can only have one secure attachment. If you are having secure attachments with your own biological parents, and you have a secure attachment with your nanny, there's no major issue. I think the problem would start if there was an issue with attachment in either places. Yeah.
So the problem would be then if you are only attached to your nanny or yeah. you're more securely attached to your nanny and they leave, then it gets harder.
It does. It does get harder.
What? So if the anxiety persists, it turns into a disorder, and you know that's what we're trying to prevent here. When would you classify it as a disorder?
Okay. We have strict definitions that we have to use, medical definitions. So an anxiety disorder, a child has to fulfill three criteria. For example, refusal to go to school, the physiological symptoms where they feel their heart rate going up or they demonstrate it, you know, being sweaty palm, pale face, breathing rapidly. And so there are particular features that we need to fulfill, but that this affects the child's functioning in their home, family environment, their social environment, so that's usually school. as well, and as well as their functioning.
We have a phone call from Sophie. Good afternoon, Sophie.
Hi.
Hi. Have you got a question?
Yes, actually I have two, but the first one is about the anxiety on getting on planes.
Yes, Sophie.
That happened to my son. Uh-huh. And so after the whole MH370 and all that, he really does have a lot of anxiety and he will cry. And, you know, in our recent holiday trip, we got him on the plane, but it was so uncomfortable for him. So I was just wondering whether there were any ways to ease his fear while flying or, you know, make it easier for him.
Hi, Sophie. Can I ask you, was the trip back easier than the trip going on?
Was easier, yes, but even then there was apprehension before we left.
Okay, sometimes it's good to read, you know, to go, if you've been on holidays with him previously and you've got photos and stuff like that, to go through that with him, okay, and, you know, point out to him that, you know, there's so many flights that take off and land every day. And this was just a one-off. Can I ask how old your child is? Sorry.
He's nine.
He's nine, yeah. So I would talk through things like that with him and actually maybe even take a trip down to KLIA if you have any spare time to look at the board and see how many flights there are or even show it to him. Show it to him on the computer screen. Yeah, so you could always say, look, you know, every day for a couple of days, log on to the, I think you can get it now on online, the flights landing and departing, just to show him that there's so many flights that, that take off and land. And I think...
Without
incidents. And I think it's good that you still persisted in taking him on that trip. And, you know, now that you've made one trip, hopefully it will start getting easier. And if you have family members or family friends who do take trips, get them to talk about it, especially if they've got kids around his age as well.
No, thank you. That will help. I do have a second question if you have time.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, great. So anyway, so my son's always slept in his own room since the day he was born until he was about five, where my daughter arrived. And his nanny of 5 years left. And I think those two things were very traumatic to him. And ever since then, so this is 4 years later, he still comes into our room at night, every night, to A, make sure that we're there, because his nanny left quite abruptly without any explanation or telling him.
Yeah.
And he will come into our room to make sure that we're there. And if possible, will actually want to sleep with us through the night. And this, you know, it's been going on for a while and I just don't, now he's going to be 10. I don't know how to wean him off that. But I can see a genuine fear in him, which is why we're quite, okay, you know, we allow him to do it. But I don't think he should do it for much longer.
Yeah, I think you need to sit down with him, have a chat about the fact that he's turning to double digits now.
Yeah.
And that comes with a whole set of responsibilities, one of which is being able to sleep through in his bedroom. I would maybe start a little reward chart. So, you know, maybe initially you say, okay, if you can sleep through one night in your room without waking up, there is a reward tag to it. And I always say to parents, try not to make these rewards too material or too expensive, because this is going to be something you're going to be doing for a long time. And when he sees it's achievable and he can do it, you make a big deal out of it and then you stretch it to two nights. And, you know, it needs to be consistent and you need to be firm about this. So the other thing is you and your husband need to start deciding. So if he wakes up and comes into your room, you take him back to his room. You say goodnight, but you don't lie in bed with him. And initially, so we call this the, you know, it's like training a baby to sleep by themselves. You stand by their bed and then you stand 3 feet away and then you stand at the door and then you move out that way. So if the fear is that intense, you may even have to do that.
Well, now the only way to get him out is to have my husband or myself lie in bed with him when we bring him back. But the minute we leave, then he gets anxious again.
Okay, you need to talk to him before you... you need to have a proper chat and sit down and say, we're doing this together. Has he ever had any sleepovers?
Yes, he actually has, but he has two or three friends whom he's very comfortable with, whom he's been friends with since he was a baby, that he's okay doing that with. But otherwise, not really.
Okay.
Not even at his grandparents' house, he would. You know, he always, if we're around,
yeah,
then he wants to be with us. The sleepovers happen when he knows, like, say we're traveling and we say, okay, but you know, spend the night with one of your good friends, and then he's still picking one.
Okay. I think you need to talk to him about why he's anxious as well.
About why he feels
why
the need
he feels
to do
the
this.
Need to do this. Yeah. You know, and maybe a fear inside that needs a little bit more help than what I'm telling you now. But, you know, what is the fear about, or whether there is?
Oh, dear, we lost Sophie. But no, I think that sounds like very sound advice. I mean, if he can go for sleepovers with friends, then hopefully.
He can, yes.
Yes. We have more questions from listeners, and also we're waiting to hear from you if you'd like to give us a call. That number is 03-77-109-000. You can reach us that way. You can also drop us a text at 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. We'll be back after the market update. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You are still listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin in the studio with Dr. Rajini Savanandhan, consultant developmental pediatrician. We're discussing anxiety in children, including separation anxiety, not wanting to go to school, the works. If you've got any questions about your child, you can give us a call. That number is 03-77-109-000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet at BFM Radio. We have a question via text. I adopted my son when he was 6 months old. From then until now, when he's 20 months old, he will constantly rock his body back and forth. Is this a sign of an attachment problem, and how do I need to stop? And do I need to stop him? How do I do that? This is from Sarah.
Okay, I think, you know, it's you can't diagnose that there is an attachment problem just from one symptom like that. But if the rocking is persisting, I would want to know when he rocks. Some children rock themselves to sleep because that's their, or rock themselves as a self-soothing behavior. Obviously, if this is behavior is persistent throughout the day, I would be concerned. And I would want to know about his other developmental milestones. Is he an engaging child, you know, in terms of his behavior, how he would behave in particular situations? So it's difficult to say, Sarah, about the rocking. It depends when it happens, how often it happens, and if it's associated with other issues as well.
For parents who notice rocking in children, what are some of the chief concerns that they should be considering?
Okay, again, it depends at what age you notice the rocking.
And with what does it come?
Yeah. So, you know, some children rock because actually they, again, like I mentioned, it's a self-soothing behavior. Especially if these children have, over the first few months, that's the way that parents have put them to sleep. So, you know, this is the persistent use of the sarong, which we would not encourage. The persistent use of, you know, parents creating their children to sleep and walking around. So the child then gets used to that being the way that they can soothe themselves. When you talk about older children, when they start rocking, I would also start thinking about whether this child may be masturbating themselves, especially girls, because that's how they would. Now, it can be a normal behavior depending on the age and when it happens. So many little girls, especially if they're 3 and 4 and they do it and the parents keep reprimanding them, they stop doing it in public. But occasionally you may catch them doing it at the edge of the chair when nobody's watching. So again, you know, it depends when and how often this behavior is happening.
And that would also determine whether or not you really need to be concerned
yes.
about it and seek help.
Yes.
Okay. Going back to that point earlier about preventing it from becoming a full-blown disorder, because that's obviously something that you want to avoid, can anxieties be managed at their early phases to prevent it from becoming a disorder?
Yeah, and I think if parents know the right methods to do it. So, for example, Sophie earlier was talking about her son who had this anxiety about flying. Despite knowing his anxiety, they still went ahead, although it was difficult. You know, I think that was good. And obviously, she's the sort of parent who is trying to work on this. If not, she wouldn't have been calling. So I think, you know, that's very important that you start to address some of these behaviors at this age and give children coping mechanisms, actually. That's the important thing. We build their resilience and hopefully that carries them into adulthood so it doesn't become an issue later on.
We talk a lot about intervention as well. I mean, is it important to catch early on? And also when we say things like we build their coping mechanisms, at what point do we then kind of sign it off to them? Because if you catch it very early, I would imagine if we're talking about, I don't know, under two, a lot of these coping mechanisms will be kind of put on the parent to do.
Yes.
At what point do you kind of hand it off and say, okay, this is how we need to start you off now?
I think it depends on the cognitive ability of the child as well as how articulate they are in expressing themselves. You know, I would say that nowadays we're very lucky that we are increasingly having psychologists around who actually know how to manage children, even in the preschool years, before they're very articulate, through things like play therapy, sand therapy. Now, this needs particular training. And, you know, I often get parents when I do worry that the child is not getting improving in terms of the strategies I've given to parents, that I refer them on to other health professionals. Parents start thinking that, oh no, my child has got a disorder already. No, we're actually doing this to prevent this from getting worse. And so we often do need the help of other professionals in dealing with that. If you take a school-age child, for example, you know, if parents, and we know now that if we involve parents in the especially the cognitive behavioral interventions that we do, parents then are empowered to know when their child is developing these symptoms and aiding the child and saying, okay, remember how we tackled it the last time? We're going to do it this way. So it's never that you throw it back at the child and the child does it on by themselves. It's a family thing.
It's an ongoing process.
Yes, yes. Even into adolescence, and we tend to forget that.
As you know, you might pull away from your parents during that point in time. How do you kind of keep in touch when somebody starts to become 11 or 12 and, you know, they don't want to talk about either their anxiety anymore, yeah, or they especially do not want to talk about it with their parents?
Then you do need to get professional help with that. You know, quite often teenagers, adolescents, they prefer talking to peers, and there are, you know, there are therapists who do peer group therapy as well, but they also are maybe happier talking to a third party.
In the process of managing an anxious child or in trying to help a child become less anxious, what happens if we fail to control our own emotions or we just get overwhelmed by it and become anxious ourselves? You know, how can parents care for themselves in these situations?
I think, you know, as a parent, I can relate to that a lot. I think it's about check and balances, isn't it? I think it's about trying to check yourself, especially when you have a child who is truly anxious, about how you deal with that. And yeah, we make mistakes, but when that happens, you go back to the child and say, I've made that mistake, I'm sorry. Let's start again. And I think if things really, you know, are getting a bit too much, parents need help themselves. So that's why when we refer kids on for intervention or therapy, we're actually referring on the whole family, not just the child.
Yeah. On that note, when would professional help be needed? You know, because there could be a whole host of reasons why a child might be feeling anxious.
Yeah.
There could be a whole host of reasons why that anxiety might feed itself and get worse.
Yeah.
When do you know, okay, the time has come, we need to go see a doctor?
Okay. I think parents need to know that for themselves, especially when they start seeing that child's anxiety is affecting family time or social situations that, you know, other typical children or other children are enjoying, and you know, it's affecting the child's overall social involvement. I think that's the time that you do need to start looking and saying, okay, maybe, you know, I'm not handling this well myself. Before it gets worse, maybe I should go get some help now. And it's nothing taboo about getting help. And I think that's important. You know, people are happy to come to see a doctor for a cough and a cold, but they find it very difficult to come in to talk about these difficult behaviours. I think sometimes we see parents coming in with the cough and the cold because they want to talk to you about these issues as well.
So you would encourage parents... In other words, parents do not need to fear that doctors wouldn't take it as seriously as a cough and a cold?
You know, I'd like to say yes, but of course, obviously, it depends the situation in which you meet a doctor. If the doctor's in a rush and doesn't have that time, you may need to say to the doctor, you know, can I have some time to talk about another issue? And I think then the doctors may be able to make time. But I hope doctors don't, you know, push parents away and say, oh, it's fine, they'll just grow out of it, which is often what we hear parents complain about.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rajni. I've been speaking with Dr. Rajni Savanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician. We've been talking about anxiety in children, and you've been listening to Health and Living today on The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.